agent in them, moved to them, and so forth, came in rather late. And both David Kay and some earlier press reports have suggested even that a number of Iraqi generals were deceived and right. thought, for example, that although they didn't have chemical weapons in their unit, the units on each of their flanks did. And I think that's part of the explanation for how things could have been wrong, again, assuming they are, which is that there was, according to David Kay again, a deception program by the Iraqi government. And indeed, in one of David's formulations, he suggested Saddam Hussein himself did it.
You know what? I'm not going to even let you go on with that rhetoric, fool. First you babble out, Saddam may have moved the weapons. Where did he move them to? Up Boy George's ass? This is ridiculous. Then you had the nerve to try to garble out this nonsense about, well, different generals thought that while they didn't have the weapons of mass destruction, other generals did. Shut up. On down the line from Condoleezza Whore Rice to colon cancer pile to Dumsfeld to people like yourself and, of course, Boy George were saying you knew exactly where those weapons were. Now, all of a sudden, you want to play this merry-go-around game and then even speculate that even Saddam may not have known. He just thought there was enough. The real weapon of mass destruction needs to be destroyed. The U.S. Empire. And that's all that matters. Which means slave time. Check this out. Listening to 104.1, 96.3 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, slave revolt time. Tonight we're going to shoot our way into this pseudo-Negro intellectual slash professor from one of these Ivy League schools named Henry Louis Gates. And we're going to get to the core of what he and others mean by integrating into American society beyond the color line and beyond one's own imagination. And then we're going to explore some more Wrath of the Empire on Sam's Plantation. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Why is we Americans? Boo-dee-da, 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 boo-doo-doo, bee-dee-dee-dee, boo-dee-boo-dee-boo-boo-boo. What I want is me, for real. I want me and myself, and what that is what I be and what I see and feel, and who is me and the what it is and who it is and when it me is what it be. I'm going to be here if I want, like I said, self-determination. But I ain't come from a foolish tribe. We wants the mule, the land. You can make it 300 years of blue chip stock in the entire operation. We want to be paid in a central bank, the average worker, farmer wage for all those years we gave it free. Plus, we want damages for all the killings and the fraud, the lynchings, the missing justice, the lies and frame-ups, the unwarranted jailings, the tar and feathering, the character and race assassinations, historical slander, ugly caricatures. For every Sambo, step and fetch it flick, we want to be paid. For every hurtful thing you did or said, for all the land you took, for all the rapes, all the rosewoods and black Wall Streets you destroyed, all the miseducation, jobs lost, segregated shacks we lived in, the disease that ate and killed us, for all the mad police that drilled us, for all the music and dances you stole, the styles, the language, the hip clothes you cop, the careers you stop. All these are suits. Specific litigation as represent we, be like we for reparations for damages paid to the Afro-American nation. Do-dee-da. 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 We want education for all of us and anyone else in the black belt hurt by slavery, for all the native peoples, even them poor white people you show all the time is funny, all them Abners and Daisy Mays, them Beverly Hillbillies who never got to know Beverly Hills, who never got to Harvard on their grandfather's wheels. We want reparations for them, right on, for the Mexicans whose land you stole, for all of North Mexico, you call it Texas, Arizona, California, New Mexico, Colorado, all that, all that, all that, all that. Be-dee-da, doo-doo. Ba, 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 doo, doo, doo. All that you got to give up. Autonomy and reparations to the Chicanos and the Native Americans whose soul you ripped out with their land. Give self-determination, regional autonomy. That's what Maui is asking, and they're going to do the same when they demand it like us again in their own exploited name. Yeah, the education, that's right. 200 years. We want a central stash, a central bank with democratically elected trustees and a board elected by us all to map out from the referendum we set up what we want to spend it on to build that Malcolm sense self-determination as self-reliance and self-respect and self-defense, the will of what the good Dr. Du Bois beat on, true self-consciousness, simply the psychology of freedom. Boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da, be-dee-da, boo-dee-da, da, ba, 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 boo-dee, boo-dee, boo, boo, boo. Then we can talk about being American. Then we can listen without the undercurrent of desire to first set your ass on fire. We will only talk of voluntary unity, of autonomy, as vective arms of self-determination if there is democracy in you. That is where it will be shown. This is the only way we as Americans. This is the only truth that can be told. Otherwise, there is no future between us but war, and we is rather lovers and singers and dancers and poets and drummers and actors and runners and elegant heartbeats of the sun's flame. But we is also at the end of our silence and sit down. We is at the end of being under your ignorant smell, your intentional hell. Either give us our lives or plan to forfeit your own.
You know what time it is now. Shameless file time. And the candidate for the shameless file is none other than Professor Henry Louis Gates. This is a Negro professor from one of those Ivy League schools. And recently he's put together a PBS piece called Beyond the Color Line, where he attempts to, in his words at least, examine where black people are in the year 2004 and what more we need to do to accomplish people like Martin King's quote-unquote dream. Well, we're about to explore what that really means for black people, the people throughout the world, and within the context of the crisis of world imperialism that we see playing out. So first off, Let's hear Gates do his little introductions to his show, and then we'll go from there. Check this out.
In 1963, the largest civil rights march in history took place in Washington, D.C. Crossing the bridge over the mighty Potomac, heading into Washington, D.C., there's the Lincoln Memorial. Washington is located where it is because it was geographically in the center of the United States. But it really marks the gateway to the South. You know, I was always afraid to go to the South because the South, for a black person, is the home of racism, the Klan, segregation. But it was also the home of the civil rights movement. And the home of the greatest civil rights leader of all, Dr. Martin Luther King. And it was here that he gave the greatest speech of his life in August of 1963 when he said that, "I have a dream.
We will be able to transform the dangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today."
I'm heading south, something I'd never dreamed I'd do as a child, to find out how the South has changed since Dr. King's assassination in 1968. What's become of his dream of racial integration? Slavery ended in 1865, but life for black people in the South remained a nightmare of poverty and terror. Racial segregation was the law of the land. Black men could be lynched capriciously, arbitrarily. We used to joke that southern cities had a sign that said, "Nigger, read and run. And if you can't read, run anyway." Millions did, fleeing north for a better life. Ironically, a century later, black people in the hundreds of thousands are flocking back. I was in Washington at the site of Dr. King's famous speech to meet a man I hope could explain the surprising development, the actor Morgan Freeman. Morgan was born in Memphis. Like many of his neighbors, his family migrated to Chicago when he was a boy. And yet, despite his wealth and fame, he has chosen to return to the South and make his home in Mississippi.
So people ask me when I went home to live after becoming this major persona. And good Lord,
what is wrong with you?
You can live anywhere in the world you want to. Why you come here? I said, because I can live anywhere in the world I want to. That's why. This is home. This is where my roots are. This is where my parents are buried. This is where I've always felt safest.
But what is it about the South that's different for a black person than the North or the West?
I think we built the South, and we know it. I do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, what I own in the South isn't because I went and bought it. What I own is my place there. Because my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather, my great-grandmother, my great-grandfather, great-great-grandmother, great-great-grandfather, I mean, all the way back to my great-great-great-grandmother, mm-hmm. who happened to be a Virginian. That's where they had the farms. Either they or they got her off a ship.
Mm-hmm. But, right.
Yeah, I don't see that anything traveling around the country and living in different places, I could never see that any place was better racially than Mississippi.
You never experienced racism as a kid in the South?
Yes, of course I did. That's not the point. Whether I experienced racism in the South is not it.
Right.
Is where else did I experience it?
Right, like in the North.
Yeah, you know, it's, I don't care anything about experiencing racism in the South. I don't and won't now.
No, right.
So.
But our image of the South was not of a nurturing place. I mean, the image that I was raised with of the South was it's a place of the Klan,
yeah.
A place of racism.
Yeah, you weren't going to find any less racism.
In the North?
No. It's going to be more insidious and more painful. Because you're given to think that Oh, it's different here.
Mm-hmm. You're free, boy. Right, right. So you'd be buried there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My mother and father buried right there in front of the house.
Oh, they are?
Oh, yeah.
This is your home place?
Yeah.
Oh, so you went back to your home place?
I went back to home.
Wow, man. Very few of us can do that.
Yeah, that's true. But those of us who can and do will be, I think, will be very pleased in later years when I sit on the front porch with a rocking chair, eat watermelon, fan the flies, and say, why do we give this up?
All right, so you can get an idea. This is kind of an anti-intellectual minstrel performance going on. When Gates talks about how it's ironic that blacks in the hundreds of thousands are flocking back to the South, he's doing this and giving people the impression and pretense that blacks have now found that the South to be something that we did not know before. That somehow now that's the oasis. That's the paradise. As if blacks came north because they were under the illusion that it was some kind of paradise. No. The reality is that aside from brutal Jim Crow and Black Code terrors that were taking place in the South to engineer black people into mired poverty and deprivation, after World War II especially, when the capitalist markets throughout the world in Eastern Europe, you know, France, Germany, and Russia, and where Japan, their industrial base was destroyed. These were the capitalist competitions, competitors to the U.S. And with their industrial bases destroyed, they could no longer produce the cars and the refrigerators, which is what all of this capitalist war and destruction is all about in the first place. Who's going to sell who what refrigerator, and who controls the markets to sell each other the refrigerators, the oil of the world, etc. So the U.S. had a flood of economic production capacity and capabilities, because the other competitors' markets and systems, industrial systems, had been collapsed through imperial wars. So this provided for not just white Americans, but for black folks, a massive opportunity for work. And this is how you saw and why you saw a flooding of black people to the northern industrial cities, into areas where there were opportunities on as longshoremen, Richmond, Oakland, you know, Chicago, etc. I don't even need to go on and on. So basically, there was an opening for opportunity for black folks to work because there was such an abundance of jobs that the same type of mechanism of control that the South had, the North couldn't have, because it needed so much, so many workers. It wasn't that they were any quote-unquote friendlier towards black people or had any kind of more friendly attitude, but after World War II and during World War II, they needed labor. That's how women were able to penetrate into the industry. It wasn't all of a sudden they had a transformation about their attitudes towards women. They needed the labor. So black people seized the opportunity. And most of the opportunity was in the North. Now, once the capitalist markets got back into formation in Japan and Europe, you know, so on and so forth, and they started to put their product back onto the market in the late 60s, early 70s, you've seen a steady decline in wage income of the American workers. And with the U.S. being able to penetrate much of the third world, in its Cold World imperial dominance through many vehicles like the School of the Americas, it was able to at the same time find low-wage, high-repression areas. So when the capitalists throughout the world started to compete again, and then the U.S. was trying to drive down the wages of American workers to compete with its capitalist competitors, a way to offset the resistance of the workers in this society was basically to start sending some of those jobs off into South America, since they had imperialized and penetrated and basically banana republicized many of those regions. So it was class warfare. So then you've seen a collapse in many of the urban industrial bases in the North that once existed for black people in the North. So black people being pragmatic and seeing what the hell is going on, if you live in, you know, central LA, and you've seen over the last 25 years some 150 to 200,000 jobs evaporate from the industrial base, and where your grandfather and father were easily able to get jobs working in the industry for cars or whatever, and now those have all gone up in smoke, you may reconsider your options. So the fact that black people are relocating and stuff like that has nothing to do with all of a sudden, you know, the South being some kind of, this is all rhetoric. But it's said in such simplistic terms without being or even attempting to be analytical. Is it said in this kind of like a Wizard of Oz type of land? Now, then you got Morgan Freeman saying, you know, well, the South is where I've always felt safest. Well, the fact of the matter is if you feel the safest in the South, then that in reality is an indictment on America. Because there's no place in America where black people are really safe. And the fact that you could feel safest in any part of America where you still have vicious incidents going on is kind of a... Well, let me put it this way. Here you have recently Tulia, Texas. 10% of the black population gets rounded up and thrown into prison off the testimony of one little punk pig, one punk cop. And 10% of the black population is rounded up on these phony drug charges. Then, before that, you had the Mississippi jail lynchings, when all of these blacks were being found dead in their jail cell. Many, or all of them, were being accused of committing suicide. One black person who was supposed to go off to college the next day was found hung, and he had his hands tied behind his back. This is how vicious it is. Now, in Mississippi, where Morgan is now, you have the Jackson Advocate newspaper, this brother who's been putting out the Advocate. And not too long ago, his place got firebombed because they still have the nerve to talk about the plight and injustices that go on for black people in Mississippi in the South. So this whole thing about you know, feeling safest and presenting the South as some kind of quote unquote new South, where Freeman said, I don't and won't experience racism now. I mean, this is silly. People who've listened to Slave Revolt have heard me do commentary, for example, Mississippi Goddamn, where I go into the black church burnings. And the black church burnings were in part predicated on controlling the black vote. They were terrorizing black people, primarily in the South, to control the vote because of the numbers of black people in Mississippi and Alabama and, you know, Georgia, etc. So for this Negro to get up here and just ignore some of this recent history, this vile recent history, is actually nothing but an abomination. So with Freeman winding up saying, now it has many of us thinking, why did we give this up? Well, see, not all black people live on acres and acres of land. Many black people in the South, just like the North, are living in dire poverty. So to focus in on Freeman, you know, a rich actor, well, I mean, we're talking someone who has millions of dollars. For the average person, regardless of what color they are, if you got millions of dollars in your back pocket, yeah, you can live good. I mean, this is silly. Why would you focus in on Freeman? And if you are going to talk to Freeman, why not other people from different economic backgrounds in the South? So this gives you an indication of how simplistic Gates is trying to engineer this and act like, as I said before, blacks are flocking back. You know, it's like, look, even there's the movie called A Raisin in the Sun. It's the old classic movie with Sidney Poitier and all of that. And it takes place in the urban Chicago where, you know, three generations of people are in a Chicago, you know, project. The mother of Sidney, then Sidney, who's the son and father of like an 8-year-old kid, and his wife, and Sidney's sister. They all live in this cramped apartment, and Sidney's trying to do various maneuvers to pursue his dream. He's basically a chauffeur, and he wants to try to invest money in different things like that that has been given to the mother from the father who passed away. So she got some kind of inheritance, and Sidney wants to invest it. And she doesn't want to invest it like he does. She, you know, and put it into any kind of business like a bar or anything. She just wants to buy a home or something stable like that. And Sidney says to her, you know, why are you trying to stop me from my dreams? When you and father came here, came to the north from the South, you were trying to pursue your dreams, didn't you? And then you saw that it wasn't much different in the North than it was in the South. So, in other words, my whole point, this movie was made like in the 50s. Black people were already talking about that then. We weren't in any kind of illusion about what the hell was going on in Mississippi, Chicago, Mississippi, Oakland, Mississippi, L.A., or Mississippi, Alabama. It's all Sam's plantation. We're just trying to navigate our way through it. So to get into all of this little, you know, superficial rhetoric, and you've even had movies, like classic movies like Raisin in the Sun, which just about every black person is seen on the planet, or at least in America, North America, it's just a joke. And then, you know, as far as them talking about we have an image of the South not being very nurturing, as if implying that we had an image of the North being nurturing. Look, once again, this is Negro mystic rhetoric. The South is not a nurturing place as a structural society of capitalist domination. But obviously, black people didn't think the North was. Why do you think there was all of these riots in the North? The Watts riot, riots in Chicago, riots in Philadelphia. There was riots all up and down the North. There historically have been. So black people never had the illusion, just trying to navigate pragmatically to enrich and better our lives in this brutal, insane, savage society. That's the real world. Now, you know, many people know I'm not all that much into this Martin King character, but let's see how Gates ascribes the meaning of King's death. So let's see what Gates has to say, and we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Dr. King was standing here with his friends. He was shot from that little window over there, those three windows, the one on the right, rimmed in white. He fell backwards here, and all this, of course, was was covered with blood. There's a famous photograph of all of his friends pointing to that little window as the place where the shot came from. And a whole movement, a 100-year-old movement, could be ended with one bullet shot from that window up there.
Okay, so once again, there's something kind of sick going on when you hear Gates. This is a professor talking about the movement collapse once the bullet hit King. This is kind of like a cult of personality type of situation. And that now that Jesus is gone, maybe our souls can't be saved. What is this? Look, much of the quote-unquote civil rights movement was in decline and in defeat. Everyone knows that a King and company had basically got defeated in their struggles in Chicago because it was a different animal. It wasn't the same form of overt all the time segregation. So many of the different techniques and struggles that had been somewhat successful in the North, in the South, took on a whole nother form and element in the South. So many forms that were successful in the South, you know, it would take a whole nother strategy in the North. And of course, this brought up other dynamics, and other organizations were starting to get the ear of the masses, and you started to see the development of many elements of the Black resistance movement take on other forms that were more widespread than quote-unquote integration, and what that really means. Now, I'll get more into that in a little bit later, but let's next go into how Gates goes and talks to a colored from Tennessee who's gone from protester to protector of Sam's plantation. So let's explore that and take it from here. Check this out.
Dr. King's life ended in Memphis, but did his dream of a fully integrated America die with him? To find out, I asked the man who has spent the last 40 years fighting for racial equality in this city, the mayor of Memphis, Willie Herenton.
When I was 28 or 29 years old, I marched with Dr. King on behalf of the sanitation workers, and we wore this sign saying, "I am a man." I was about 28, and I had the sign on me. The reason we had to say we were men was because of the way we were treated less than men.
After a career as an educator and a political activist, Dr. Herenton became Memphis's first Black mayor. Since 1991, he served 3 terms in office, and now he's running for a 4th term. Did you ever, in your wildest dreams, think that you would be the man at City Hall?
You know, obviously, I never thought that I'd be on the inside of this building as the mayor, when in the civil rights movement, I was outside protesting against the mayor, because Memphis was a mean-spirited city. It was similar to many other southern cities. I remember one evening, a white man got on the bus and forced my mother and me to get up. We were at the middle of the bus, and he said, "Hey, girl," he said, "you know, you're not supposed to be sitting here." And my mother and I, we got up, and we sat farther in the back of the bus. I remember the separate water fountains. I remember going in the back of restaurants. I mean, you couldn't go in the front. Mm-hmm. The theaters, you had to go in the side doors, or you had to go upstairs. You couldn't go in the front of theaters. If you wanted to try on garments for size, you could not do that if you were Black.
Where were you when you heard the news Dr. King had been shot?
Oh, man. I was driving back to the inner city of Memphis. I had my radio on to a Black radio station, and then it came on. They said, "We have bad news. Dr. King was not only shot, but he has died." And I remember just, I mean, I was just overwhelmed, you know, with emotion. I couldn't believe that. Because I had seen him in Mason Temple. It might have been the night before or a couple of nights when he gave that speech that, you know, I've been to the mountains.
It was the night before.
It was the night before. I was in the church at Mason Temple.
Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead.
I didn't know that that was going to be the last time that I'd hear him speak.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
There was no other human figure like Dr. Martin Luther King. He moved the conscience of America. And all of a sudden, he's assassinated in our city, in Memphis. This is the city where I was born. Now, this event could have occurred in any American city, but it occurred in Memphis.
Okay, so now we get into some of the heart of what I'm talking about as far as, in my opinion, Gates is kind of manipulative in some ways, or in many ways, actually. And what's going on is that he's doing the kind of quote-unquote examination of King's dream of racial integration. But it's just put on that platonic level without examining the aspect of what black people are integrating into, for example. See, part of the reason there has been and was a fostered a split in the consciousness of element of the black masses during the 60s is because as Malcolm and others were developing, Malcolm started on a line of human rights, and that started to be very critical of the role and policy of the U.S. Empire, and started to question what role the U.S. Empire is having on the world. So many black people of the time started to also question the role of the U.S. and the role of capitalism and imperialism. Because Malcolm was one of the first of the human rights leaders in America at the time to critique and criticize Sam's role in places like Vietnam. You know, he was doing that in the mid and early 60s. This is well before King later came out in 68. Malcolm was criticizing, and see, much of the civil rights movement dynamic, and it does have a certain element of a class dynamic within the black working class. Their role was primarily to integrate into American society. Let me in, massa. Let me in. That's it. You know, where the core of black folks, especially in urban areas, who had been somewhat already more integrated in, from the aspect of living in the North, you didn't see the same signs. In some cases, you would go to school where, you know, whites had been, you know, went to school, et cetera, et cetera. The situation was a little bit more critical and developed into a critique of the policies of the U.S. and saying, is this something as a system that we want to integrate into unconditionally? And there you see the hallmark of the dynamics of the split and some of the elements that later became called the Black Liberation Movement. In other words, if someone is an imperialist and has an imperialist system, do we as a people want to unconditionally just want to integrate into the system and have positions like a Colin Powell? What does that mean for black people to be a Colin Powell, you know, a general? in a system that is wreaking havoc on the world. We end up basically, in essence, being the same type of person and playing the same type of role that we criticize Bull Connor of being. Colin Powell is an international Bull Connor. So Gates, though, does not want to address this aspect. And he does not want black people to address that element. All he wants to do is talk on a platonic level as far as how have we integrated into the system. And he brings up like this particular mayor who at one time was a protester, but now he's a mayor. But what does that mean for the masses? We've had black mayors all throughout. We've had black mayors from Oakland to Mississippi. What does that mean for the condition overall of black people and the role that black people make in our own overall struggle? And without examining that and thinking that just because some Negro now has a top hat on a piece of a masses plantation, that's somehow liberation, that's an illusion. The Jim Crow system was very similar to the apartheid system in South Africa. Jim Crow and apartheid are both like scaffolding. White supremacy uses scaffolding to build the house of inequality. Once the house of inequality is built, in other words, once whites are in dominant control of corporations, of water systems, of industry, in other words, of the core fabric of the capitalist system, then you can take scaffolding down because the house of inequality still stands strong. So the fact that Jim Crowism were dismantled is similar to how apartheid system as we know it, which is overt forms of segregation and barring black people from being involved in certain elements of business and this and that. The fact that those things were dismantled does not mean that black oppression was or is going to be dismantled. Because look at South Africa. Before the end of apartheid, black white people were 5% of the population. They own over 80% of the land, the best land. After apartheid, white people are 4 to 5% of the population. White people own and control over 80% of the land. In other words, they still control and own it, but they use the apartheid system as a mechanism to regiment their control and dominance in the market system. So this whole thing of just talking about the dismantling of Jim Crowism and getting particular positions on masses plantation without analyzing how from South Africa, now they're privatizing the water, and one brother recently went to jail because he stole a cup of water, quote unquote. He stole a cup of some damn water in South Africa, his native land, but now it's controlled. Now it's privatized because that's how the market system works. But we see the same things happening here. So what does it mean for black people in Mississippi that the Mississippi River is starting to collapse because of the eco-destruction and has a massive dead zone in it? Without critiquing the system itself, then basically you're just tap dancing in fairy tale land. Now, also, the colored mayor mentioned that, you know, back in the 60s, we were treated less than men. Look, under this market system, the masses of people have always traditionally been treated less than men. Before the Civil War, white folks, less than 5% of white folks in the South could read. Now, that basically tells you there that the privatized engineering of economic control by the white slaveocracy class really didn't care about the masses of white folks, so the masses of white folks were in dire poverty themselves. Actually, after the Civil War, white literacy went up over 20%. So black participation in crushing the South actually helped liberate white folks. So what I'm saying is, in this whole market system, all the people in the working class are treated less than men and women, but there are specialized people who have been completely subhumanized. Black folks and Indians who lived in the South before they were what? Exterminated. So one could say that they were beyond treated less than human. So, and it was all in an effort of the development of the market system in the South. Now, so this is why rhetoric about, you know, how the colored mayor saying King moved the consciousness of America and all of this kind of, you know, symbolic, rosy stuff. Look, black folks were organized. Black folks had a tradition of organizing. After World War II, you had a social dynamic and current that gave black people more confidence to shift in more momentum. Historically, black people have been the most organized sector of the of people in America. Black people belong to some kind of organization, whether it was connected to the church or some workplace, et cetera, et cetera, because in part our survival depended on it. So it allowed us to move as a strong social force. And King became an important voice in that force. But what moved the conscience, quote unquote, of America basically was the realization that, one, they could no longer do what they had been doing without creating more trouble and havoc, and two, on a certain level, they didn't need to maintain rigid Jim Crowism. It had played its purpose in the South. Black people in many ways were ostracized and isolated in the North, which is why you saw so many riots back then, but it didn't have the same form of Jim Crowism. So as a matter of fact, like I said before, in many places you had blacks go to the same school as whites in the North. So you know, this is what I mean by, you know, getting into this whole bit about, you know, we couldn't try on certain garments and we, you know, had to drink it separate, drinking water and all of that. This is more symbolic than anything else. I mean, it's a warped mentality. But right now, today, it wasn't that many years ago. We're talking less than 5 or 6 years ago when Denny's restaurant had to pay out millions of dollars to black people all over the country, from San Jose to, you know, Alabama, because they had it encoded to discriminate specifically against black people, either not serve them or make them pay a cover charge, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, Gates is playing a fairly simplistic and insidious game by how he's constructing the argument about where we are now and deciding who he's going to in the South. This colored mayor you just heard, and then before that, it was Morgan Freeman, a rich Negro with millions of dollars in his pocket who can live damn good anywhere. I mean, you got millions of dollars in your pocket, you can live anywhere. You can live on Mars good. But now let's go into another area where Gates is exploring how well we have been integrated and what that all means. Check this out.
Well, I've often said that if there's any city in America that should accentuate the values and the principles that Dr. King stood for, it should be Memphis.
One of the most dramatic examples of how Memphis has embraced the ideals of Dr. King is the transformation of its police force. During the Civil Rights era, the police in the South were symbols of institutional racism, brutality, and terror. They were the official face of white oppression. Even today, I'm always frightened when I see a flashing police car speeding up behind me. Like many black people growing up here, James Bolden was terrified of the police. But in 1968, he joined the Memphis Police Department, determined to change things. He was one of only 65 black officers in a force of 2,000. Today, he's the chief.
You're 20 years old, and it's just a few months after Dr. King's assassinated. What was the force like?
It was male, white, dominated. When I came on the job, we didn't have many aspirations of ever achieving any type of rank or anything like that, because commanding officers, black, as you know, as far as that concerned, were practically non-existent. So we didn't see very much in form of role models or anything like that of blacks holding positions in the Memphis Police Department. We had certain areas of the city in which, you know, we could patrol, and others we couldn't.
You couldn't, even as a police officer?
Even as a police officer, we were assigned to certain areas within the city, and generally they were areas that were occupied by the black community, and we didn't police outside of that community.
In 1973, Bolden founded the Afro-American Police Association to make the police a force against racism, not an example of it. He petitioned the federal government to get more blacks hired and promoted to executive positions.
It wasn't met, you know, with open arms. There were white officers who refused to ride in a squad car with me. There were black officers who would turn their backs on me, wouldn't speak to me because they were afraid that I would bring trouble to them.
Were you worried that maybe an accident might befall you from some of your white colleagues?
That was with me every day. Every day. I would go to work. And sometimes you can't imagine getting home at night. You're so terrified, you know, because who wouldn't be when you had to face something like that and everyone is walking around you, they're wearing guns.
When did you know that you were winning? I mean, how did you build consensus? How did you melt down some of these old crackers and make them start to accept what you were trying to do?
Around the year of 1978, finally the federal government agreed that there had been discrimination in the Memphis Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
And a consent decree was entered by the city.
It took five years to admit what you could observe in five seconds, right?
Yeah. So as a result of the increase in hiring of minorities, more opportunities began to open up. You look at the city of Memphis Police Department now, I have two deputy chiefs that work under my command that are African Americans. Our precincts throughout the city are equally divided. We have women in leadership positions in the police department. You cannot find an area within the Memphis Police Department where minorities or blacks are not represented.
Hmm.
Things have changed so dramatically in the South. You know, I've had the distinction of living through the times when we could not drink at a water fountain, when we could not go to the library on a certain day, when we couldn't go to a movie, and when we couldn't eat at a restaurant. So for anyone to say that the South has not changed, then they're fooling themselves.
Okay, so once again, the way Gates has constructed this is he's gone to another color. This is the colored now chief of police. And it's either symbolic or symbolism of rigid forms of Jim Crowism, water fountainism, stuff like that. Now we can drink there. Or now we have certain positions like being a chief of police or Negroes in the police force who can also follow out masses' policies of war on drugs to round up black people and throw them into prison. In other words, what I'm saying is that there hasn't been a transformation of the way and the role of the police. It's just that now you have more blacks playing a role in the role of the police. Look, the fact that you had many blacks in South Africa who were actually cops did not mean that the oppression and the role of the police in South Africa was any different. So the fact that you now have Negro chiefs of police, as if that's supposed to symbolize, well, see, that's what Gates is doing. He's a symbolic historian, and he's a symbolic movement maker. He believes that integrating into the system without a critical examination and transformation of the system itself, or destruction of the system, is not necessary. Because, see, that's not what he believes in. Now, you have this stuff where we've seen chiefs of police all over the place in L.A. What does that mean? Nothing. We've seen Rampart Division cops run amok and roust up and throw in over 100 black and brown innocent people. And the story only gets out because one little pig gets caught stealing 8 pounds of cocaine, doesn't want to do his whole sentence, so he starts ratting on his fellow pigs. That's how the story breaks. And that's how the 100-plus people end up getting out of prison. Now, we've seen, and I mentioned before, Tulia, Texas, 10% of the black population. We've seen in Mississippi and Tennessee the annual Good Old Boy picnic, where racist cops all over the country would gather together and fly the Confederate flag, sell T-shirts of King and a crosshair, have various Redneck of the Year Award skits, where in one case one person who won the Redneck of the Year Award pretended like he was walking down the street. A watermelon falls out of a watermelon truck. He breaks open the watermelon. Inside there is a black baby doll. He shows the black baby to the crowd and says, "We must destroy the seed." Throws the doll on the ground and begins stomping it together. This is some Nazi stuff. The only reason why the case got broken, or the case came out, was some Klansmen friends of the cops, of these various different law enforcement, FBI, you know, on down the line, regular, you know, cops and stuff like that, ATF. One of them, some of them had gotten into a falling out with some of the fellow Klansmen. And when that took place, the Klansmen got upset and came to the annual Good Old Boy picnic with video cameras. And they videotaped the whole thing, showed all of these cops there, you know, all Nazi'd out, having these skits and everything, and then released it to the public. It was so vile and so obviously racist that even the Soldiers of Fortune magazine ran an article talking about how openly racist it was. Now, when the Soldiers of Fortune magazine, which is a mercenary magazine, this is a magazine for armed mercenaries to go out and get hooked up and carry out missions for the imperialists throughout the world. When even they're shocked by the blatant racism of the annual Good Old Boys, then that's saying something right there. But did Gates mention them? Did he go to some of the blacks who had encountered and found out about the annual Good Old Boys picnic? Or any of these other things like Tulia, Texas? No. Did he go to the death rows of the South where Gary Graham was executed? No, he did not. He could have done some fact-finding mission showing the disparity of blacks on death row and how and who and what it takes to get you on death row, meaning who you kill and who you don't kill, meaning what color they are. Recently, HBO did a special where it was like this little 13-year-old brother who was accused of killing a white woman. She was with her husband, and the culprit robbed and shot them. It was clear from the description, because they followed this whole case, and it was like a thing almost like OJ. They followed this whole case as they were trying to defend this brother. It was clear that he didn't fit the description of the person, except he didn't have on the same gear. It was just nothing worked. Anyway, he ends up somehow having some kind of confession, quote unquote, written up on them. Now, the confession was basically more or less beaten out of them, literally. And who was the person who beat him up to get this so-called confession? A Negro cop. So once again, without examining the role of the police, currently and historically, and just talking about now there's more Negroes in the police force, as if that in itself is a transformation of society or the police, is the height of illusion.
Yeah. Well, actually, just to mention something on the politicians, a few years ago, about 1998, that high number of elected black officials, the economic situation of black Americans has actually deteriorated from since the 60s. On this question of the police, though, this here is not funny. See, besides what Tracy just mentioned, you just... So we got a Negro cop, huh? But one really... follow it as Tracy suggested. We want to look at the trajectory, the history, the development of the police in America, and we also want to look at today. Well, you know, every time you think about, you know, this police thing really wrenches your guts, because on a certain level it doesn't seem that much has changed. But I want to tell you something, Tracy. Think about this. The reason, one of the reasons that black mayors started to show up, that police started to show up, more black police chiefs, is because there was a series of riots in the 60s. They used to call them the hot summers. And what the bourgeoisie was trying to do by having the promotion of black public officials, be they police chiefs, mayors, this type of stuff, more visible black participation. If you look at the news, you think the hell, black people doing pretty good. Got a whole lot of news announcers and everything. But this is to prevent struggle.
That's the symbolic stuff I'm talking about.
That's right. And the reason it's important to them is because they hope that it will prevent struggle. They hope that it will give the illusion of black progress. They hope that it will slow down and cool off the anger. You see. Well, Blood just became the chief of police. What's wrong with you?
And that's what Gates' role is. That's what he's doing. And that's why he's ignoring the other element of black resistance that has always been a current of critiquing what we're integrating, quote unquote, into and where we are in this society. Frederick Douglass wrote classic works about the plight of the Indians because he started to see that the struggle for black people was interconnected with what happened in the plight of Indians and the system that created the conditions for the destruction of the native aboriginal population. Now next, Gates goes into another world of the former segregation apparatus of American society. Let's see where he takes it, and then we'll take it from there. Check this.
You might want to hear some prayer.
In just 30 years, the police and the city government of Memphis have been able to make profound changes. But is that true of all institutions in the South? This is Fort Benning, Georgia, home to over 30,000 raw recruits. Percent of the United States Army is black, but historically, the military was just as segregated as the police and as the society it was charged to defend. Today, the Army boasts that it's an army of one. I asked Lieutenant Colonel Sando if the Army is as integrated as it claims.
What's this rose gallery for?
this is the battalion leadership, our chaplain, Chaplain Stokeland, a black female.
Great, not bad.
The only one I've ever seen in our Army, and she does a great job for us. Our personnel officer, our operations officer, our supply officer, and then six company commanders and their first sergeant.
Man, a lot of color on that wall.
Within our battalion, I have six companies. Two of my company commanders are black. Of the six first sergeants, three of them are black. Of the five battalions here in the infantry training brigade, one of the battalion commanders is black. Three of the command sergeant majors are black.
Mm-hmm.
From my experience, for, you know, 21 years now of commissioned service, is that, you know, I truly believe that the Army is colorblind.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe that I'm colorblind. We reward excellence.
How about just
blind? Of race, color, or creed. We promote soldiers and officers based on merit and demonstrated potential.
How can the Army achieve such spectacular results in terms of this colorblind society that you described? I mean, how does it work? The Army was notoriously racist. My father was in the Army during World War II. I mean, he had horror stories when I was growing up. And now the Army's held up as a model for what a colorblind society could be. How did you guys do that?
Well, I can't speak for, you know, the previous 50 years of racial integration. The Armed Forces were the first institution in our country to be racially integrated.
Under President Truman.
Yes, sir. So under no, you know, for no other reason than, you know, we had to make it work, and we're going to make it work.
I am the infantry!
To make this work, each barracks is assigned an equal opportunity officer to deal directly with any race complaints.
Okay, so you see right there, once again, here Gates goes in and says, now the Army is held up as a model for what a colorblind society should be. What it also should be held up as is a unconscious element of the society, and what that means for U.S. imperialism. See, there's no critique about, once again, about black people integrating into the armed force of the imperialists and what that means throughout the planet. When Ali refused to go into the Vietnam, be drafted into the Vietnam, a soldier for the Vietnam War, into the Vietnam War, all across the world, people came out in support. In Pakistan, young Pakistanians fasted for days in support of what Ali did. In other words, they saw Ali as a symbol of a black person to be emulated because he stood against being a tool of imperialism. Gates' vision of black people is not to critique the tool of imperialism, it's just to integrate into it and thereby be an apparatus of the oppression. He starts off, where, of all places, where does he start off? We're now in Fort Benning, Georgia, where there's thousands of recruits, 26% are black. Fort Benning, Georgia is the home of School of the Americas.
Certainly is.
That has devastated the planet. This school straight out of hell, as my commentary's called, outlines all types of tyranny and oppression that these graduates and their teachers have fostered on the third world. So being a part of that apparatus means you're part of the problem. You're part of an engine of destruction that's making a wasteland of society. But Gates frames black emancipation in the form of blacks integrating within into the system, not in the tradition of blacks critiquing the system or challenging the system. So this is at core, once again, where you see the discrepancy of where many blacks started to examine and re-examine what it means to be in America. So the platform of, you know, of where the Panthers stood as far as saying black men should be exempt from military service, to Malcolm's criticism the military and its imperialist role throughout Africa and Vietnam and South America, Gates does not want that element of black resistance in history to even be discussed. All we should concern ourselves with in the world of Gates is if we get a piece of the rotten pie on Massa's plantation,
eat it up.
We should be satisfied. And as long as he doesn't look at us twice for being black, for getting that piece of the rotten pie, then we should even be more satisfied. So this is the whole construct. And who does he put out as a symbol and a role model? People like Colin Powell, who's been made a buffoon. All around the world, Colin Powell has lost all credibility. Now, he should not have had credibility since he stepped into the uniform and lied about May Lie and all of that other stuff. But recently, he had the nerve to go off in Russia and say that the U.S. is not building bases in Georgia, where everyone knew they were. And they just laughed them off. Just get out of here, silly Negro. All your lies about Saddam having weapons of mass destruction and all of that, it's all been totally destroyed. They're playing tapes of him saying that Saddam doesn't have weapons of mass destruction when he made this statement in February of 2001. And then after September 2001, he starts saying it along with Condoleezza Rice and all these other thugs. They did, you know, he's discredited.
That's
but
right.
In the world of Gates.
Wait, by the way, that was the caucuses you're talking about. You're talking about Georgia, the caucuses.
Yeah.
Oh, that's serious.
Wow. But in the world of Gates, Colin Powell is a symbol of what black people should try to emulate into.
Yeah.
In other words, be from an international and human perspective part of the problem because you're part of the tool of U.S. imperialism.
Oh, no, I just... Look, militarism is one of the things that forward-thinking people have always, always fought against. In fact, Karl Liebknecht, the famous German revolutionary, once coined the term, the main enemy is at home, you see. So this, I just have to say ditto.
Next, Gates asked a fellow colored, like himself, how the military is doing. So let's check this out.
Lieutenant Colonel Sandoz's right-hand man to Sergeant Major Wilcox. I wanted to ask a black man if attitudes had really changed.
But what about this, Sergeant Major?
That's a Confederate flag. I'm personally offended by that, you know. It don't represent me as a black American because I think it's got the wrong symbol.
Will this person be a member of the infantry?
This soldier's he's an officer, which I got to figure out who that truck belongs to.
Yeah, well, you got another one in there under the mirror.
That boy
got a bag.
So I would deal with him when I figure out who car it is. I plan to make one of my cadets, though. Mm. So I'm going to deal with him.
Okay. How long have you been in the Army?
24 years.
Okay. Break it down for me. Brother to brother. You hear all this stuff about the Army, no more racism, you know, it's a model society. Is that true?
I tell you, it's not visibly seen. I came from Georgia, and I came from an environment where racism was everyday way of life. Mm-hmm. And the way I've grown to the military is leaps and bounds from where my brothers are down in South Georgia today. Mm-hmm. And so I'm grateful for the military. The military itself is a good place, but you still got people in the military, such as the young man with the flag on who have not made the mental change. Mm-hmm. They can't do it openly. It's subvert. It's underneath, mm-hmm. and you can sense it, and you see it there, but you got to root it out. In this job here, we try to not only train these guys, we've been challenged to take all the abnormal behavior that society taught them and turn them around.
That's a lot of work, brother.
Psychologically, we do wonders in 14 weeks. We talk about men who have died on the battlefield to give us our freedom and how all that blood is red. There's no colors, there's no boundaries. Every man on the battlefield are brothers. And that man you left, no matter what color he is, no matter where he come from, he's your brother.
What happens if somebody's busting your buns, right? And so you're pissed off.
Yeah.
And so you want to call him a name, under your breath even. So instead of saying, you MF, you go, you nigger. And you hear that. What do you do, Sergeant Major?
That guy goes to my office. And that guy is looked at very straightforwardly as being a racist. And I would probably deal with him personally as a Sergeant Major. And then if I, that'd be, he'd definitely get occupancy. He'd definitely get punished. He'd lose money in paycheck. Hmm. And as a minimum, and as a maximum, he can be discharged off that one state.
You make him do 10 million push-ups, you know? And stuff like that?
Well, what the drill sergeant do is probably a little more than what I do. But I tell you that it's a serious allegation, and you can't not deal with it. If you don't deal with it, it becomes okay to do.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be between you and I as buds talking on the field, and as the side to do, people often use that language.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to anybody, no matter who uses it, where they use it, it's still degrading language. Mm-hmm. Don't use it at all.
Right. So even two black people can't.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's degrading language.
Okay, you see how sad this is. And once again, he's a false intellectual. And he's a sleight of hand artist. I'm talking about Gates. Because the whole thing is all about integrating into the system of the imperialist arm, the military arm of the capitalists, as opposed to critiquing. And what does that mean? So while, of course, on a certain level, the capitalists would want its little soldiers of fortunes, its little G.I. Joes to be somewhat cohesive, because that makes them more effective on destroying and disciplining the rest of the planet. So while a white person and a black person in the U.S. killing machine army can look at each other as quote-unquote brothers, they are trained not to look at some Palestinian cat as a brother, or some Iraqi person as a brother, or some sister or brother from the southern part of the Sudan. In other words, they're trained to look at the world through big business's eyes. And when big business determines some people are expendable for collateral damage, whether they be in Iraq or Yugoslavia, then all they have to do is push the button, and these little robotic G.I. Joes will walk in unison to go off and destroy some other people that in actuality they have more class commonality with than they have with their rulers. They're just as expendable to the ruling class. They're getting hit with these depleted uranium contacts. They're being forced to pay for more than two bottles of water. They're being exploited by Halliburton and all of that. But since they've been basically hypnotized, like Gates wants them to be, into pledging their allegiance to the U.S. empire uncritically, as long as Massa does not call you a name, or as long as some of his little white disciples don't call you a name, then all's well in U.S. imperial land. This is how sick this whole process is. He should be offended, if he had any consciousness, by not just the Confederate flag, but the fact that the U.S. empire is planting its flag all over the planet and turning the whole world into a giant Indian reservation. He talks this nonsense, but he's a trained Negro. This colored a military man is a trained Negro who has the nerve to say, you know, we're all the same. We talk about the men who have died on the battlefield to protect our freedom. Did they protect, quote unquote, your freedom in Vietnam? Are they protecting your freedom in Iraq? See, this is what they want, trained monkeys. And Gates, being an uncritical Negro to the way his master runs the world and this society, as long as he's not called out of his name and is given a piece of a watermelon on the plantation, then all's well. Now, we're definitely going to have to do part two next week, because it's best that we show how he connects all things together, and we've kind of run out of time on this segment. So, hold on 1 second.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Yes, good evening, brothers and sisters. It's yours truly, Gerald Smith. And this is your Making It Plain news service. Check this out. The Secretary of Labor in the United States is an enemy of labor. Now, by law, the Labor Secretary, Elaine Chao, is required to, and I quote, to foster, promote, and develop the welfare of the wage earners of the United States. But given her record, American workers might want to make a symbolic citizen's arrest of the secretary for breaking the law, because her service has been the exact opposite. For instance, at this very moment, Cho's prime offense is promotion of changes in the overtime pay rules. Now, what they did was, the law was initially intended to exempt a small number of executive, administrative, and highly educated professional employees from the requirement that their employers pay a premium for overtime. Well, guess what? They, as usual, they took that law, charlatans that they are, and they started expanding and broadening the meaning of this law to the point to where people that work as medical technicians are not supposed to get overtime. Now, Chow bragged to a conservative think tank that she had cut her department's budget more than any other cabinet secretary. She slashed funds for enforcing federal laws governing the workplace, including safety and labor standards, practically eliminating the Department of International Affairs, which fights against child labor for higher labor standards in countries around the world. She removed labor representatives from trade and workplace safety advisory committees. Her occupational safety and health administration has withdrawn roughly 24 planned regulations, including a rule that would have required employers to pay for workers' personal protective equipment, leaving low-income and immigrant workers especially vulnerable. She offered no resistance to administrative moves to deny collective bargaining rights to many federal workers, including those in the new Department of so-called Homeland Security, unquote. Now, while she's cutting all of the enforcement of workers' protections, supposed to be Secretary of Labor, she has been doing everything she can to assist the employers up and down the line. Cho pushes her intense ideological agenda even in the smallest gestures. For example, she appointed anti-union Labor Department officials to the board of the department's Labor Hall of Fame, which pays tribute to famous American labor leaders like Mother Jones, Eugene Debs, and John L. Lewis. Last year, Cho's appointees chose chocolate magnate Milton Hershey, whose managers organized a, quote, loyal workers club in 1937 to beat, and I quote, with clubs, pipes, blackjacks, and fists, 2,000 sit-down strikers defending the desire of a majority of workers to form a union, according to a labor historian, Donald Kennedy. This is a person she puts into the Labor Hall of Fame. The choice may be an insult to workers, but it's a fitting embodiment of the values of the current Secretary of Anti-Labor. Yes, indeed, the Secretary of Labor is an enemy of labor. Now, we've got some important news for you on an investigation that reveals the Reconstruction racket in Iraq. That's right. We're not talking about profiteers. We know they profiteers. They say they profiteers. We're telling you they're racketeers. A team of investigative reporters in Iraq have found a pattern of waste, fraud, and abuse among U.S. companies receiving multi-million dollar reconstruction contracts in the country, including massive overcharges for projects, shoddy work, or a failure to complete tasks, and ignoring local experts who contend that they could do the job better. By the way, they got the nerve talking about they want a three strike. We're going to put the three strikes on you. We got a three strike policy for repeat offenders. Well, they need to have a three strike policy for repeat offenders in terms of these contractors that's ripping off all this money and get caught. And then they just kind of, all right, well, y'all just don't do that no more. They done caught Halliburton twice that I know of, excuse me. Once, overcharging the government for gas. They gave back a few million. Don't worry, it's all good. Then they caught him again where they were supposed to be feeding the troops. I don't know why the army can't feed its own troops. Can't get nobody to join that stinking thing. Yeah, it's all privatized. It's right. So they claimed 1 million meals that were never sold, that were never actually fed to the soldiers. They gave 6 million back to the government. Ain't that good enough? It's all good. So if you're a repeat offender and you are a war racketeer, I guess they don't have no kind of policy, let alone a three-strike policy. The in-depth report by Corporate Watch or Corp Watch's Pratap Kajiri and focus on the Global South...
Chatterjee.
Okay. Okay. Say that again.
Totap Chatterjee.
Okay. Tracy must know this poison. And focus on the Global South's Herbert Docena, published in the latest issue of Southern Exposure magazine, is an on-the-ground account of how U.S. taxpayer money given to Bechtel, Halliburton, and other companies is being spent. The investigative team spent 3 weeks in Iraq visiting project sites, analyzing contracts, and interviewing dozens of administrators, contract workers, and U.S. officials. Now, here are among the findings. One, despite over 8 months of work and billions of dollars spent, key pieces of Iraq's infrastructure, power plants, telephone exchanges, and sewage and sanitation systems have either not been repaired or have been fixed so poorly that they don't function. Two, San Francisco-based Bechtel has been given tens of millions to repair Iraq schools, yet many haven't been touched, and several schools that Bechtel claims to have repaired are in shambles. One repaired school was overflowing with unflushed sewage. A teacher at the school also reported that the American contractors took away our Japanese fans and replaced them with Syrian fans that don't work, billing the U.S. government for the work. Inflated, and this is number three, inflated overhead costs and a Byzantine mass of subcontracts have left little money for the everyday workers carrying out projects. In one contract for police operations, Iraqi guards received only 10% of the money allotted for their salaries. Indian cooks for Halliburton's subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root reported making just $3 a day. Yeah, that's good for Halliburton, huh? The report also reveals further details of Halliburton's contracts. For example, that the Halliburton's $2.2 billion in contracts, of that only about 10% has gone to meeting community needs, the rest being spent on servicing U.S. troops and rebuilding oil pipelines. Halliburton has also spent over $40 million in the unsuccessful search for weapons of mass destruction. Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we already know. They lying. And I quote, a handful of well-connected corporations are making a killing off of the devastation of Iraq, unquote, observes Chris Crom, publisher of Southern Exposure. The politics and process behind these deals have always been questionable. Now we have firsthand evidence that they're not even doing their jobs, unquote. Also, I tell you, one has to wonder, you know, but here it is. What will it take for us, our brothers and sisters, to stop accepting this type of just literal robbery? And here's one for you. A spice of life. Another little thing with Coke. We done told you here at Slave Revolt more than once about the fact that at the Coca-Cola facilities in Colombia, there have been murders carried out by the paramilitaries, apparently in support of Coca-Cola's management to weed out and intimidate and just assassinate trade union militants. This has been going on for some time. Well, here's another one from Coke. The Indian Parliament has banned the sale of Coke and Pepsi products in its cafeteria. Now, why would they do such a thing? Well, the ban came as a result of tests, including those by the Indian government, which found high concentrations of pesticides and insecticides, including Lindani, DDT, malathion, chlorpyrifos, in the colas, making them unfit for consumption. Some samples tested show the presence of these toxins to be more than 30 times the standard allowed by the European Union. Tests of samples taken from the U.S. were found safe. Well, is this a double standard? Yep, it sure the hell is. Is it an isolated incident? I'm sorry, friends, that's not true. Large multinationals are notorious for serving up products that have been banned in the West to new and so-called emerging markets in developing countries. Don't kid yourself. They know what the hell they're doing. So remember our new jingle. Coca-Cola kills them bugs dead. Oh, man, it's just scandalous. Absolutely scandalous. And then lastly, I want to bring to your attention a charge that was made in the Village Voice that the Reverend Al Sharpton is sleeping with the GOP. Roger Stone, the longtime Republican dirty tricks operative who led the mob that shut down the Miami-Dade County recount and helped make George W. Bush president in 2000, is financing, staffing, and orchestrating the presidential campaign of Reverend Al Sharpton. That's true. It's a fact. He's letting blood use his credit card. Buy anything you need. They keeping him out there. Now, I though think that this stuff, you know, as we go on, Sharpton says that this is phony liberal paternalism and that he can talk to anyone he wants. And he's sick of these racist double standards.
Including the FBI when he was an informant for them.
Don't be talking bad about the brother. That conk. But you know what? That's right. But I'm going to tell you something. That there's another little twist to this here. But look here. Oh, blood in here talking about the Reverend's hair. Now, you know, you might get struck now, brother. You might get struck down talking about the Reverend's hair. Because the Reverend, you understand, the Reverend need a new head. Well, people need to give him some money. The Lord want the Reverend's hair to look nice. That's what he told me. But look here. The point is this, though. All right, given that this is indeed true, and that the Reverend is indeed taking money from and working with a Republican operative, what's the big deal? Republican, Democrat? A lot of these operatives, I do want to tell y'all, work for Republicans when they get hired by Republicans, and work for Democrats when they get hired by Democrats. And even if they did it, I'll say again, ain't a dime's worth a difference. So on a certain level now, I want to say that what the Reverend has been saying, I heard him speak on CNN, and what he has been saying in public about the Democrats, in fact, is true. And that is that the Democrats talking about who going to beat Bush, he said, look, it's the Democrats going to beat the Democrats, because the Democratic Party refuses to deal with what has been known up to now as their so-called natural constituency, that is, Black Americans. No, they don't go into the black communities and seriously attempt to organize and to get people mobilized to vote. Why? Because this is the Democratic Party's line. Negroes ain't got no choice. If they're going to vote, they got to vote for us. So that's exactly what they think. And they deserve to be criticized for this. So while homeboy is supposed to be sleeping with the enemy, the real point is this here. Both of these so-called parties, it ain't nothing but one party, the property party, the Republicrats against the working class and the oppressed in America.
But the Democrats don't want to help stir up the black masses and help organize them, because once that starts happening again, which it will, it's going to twirl out of the control of both the Democrats and the Republicans Party. So the best thing for them, from their strategic position to do, since they are the enemy of us, is to let the sleeping giant sleep while we can.
Oh, I tell you, when that black steamroller gets to rolling, they in trouble. Listen, talk about steamrollers. I was at a major labor rally today. Came out pretty good. I thought it was pretty interesting. A couple of hundred people out there supporting the Oakland 25. I hope our listeners will remember April 7th. We had protesters go down to the waterfront, and the police opened up on them with so-called non-lethal weaponry. Well, they're still being charged. They're still going to court on these phony charges, trying to get them thrown out. We'll let you know what happened in court today after we get the information. That's all right now for Make It Plain News Service. Please stay with us here.
Wrap it up for Slave tonight. As it's clear that from Al Sharpton to the U.S. killing machine to Henry Gates, they want us with our heads in the ground. But what we need to do for our own salvation is to take our ideas, our analysis, and struggle to a higher ground. Until the next time, slave the vote.
Your people.